Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Hey, welcome to Extreme Genes, America's family history show on ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Our show today is a best of Extreme Genes with some of our favorite stories from the past, including coming up a little bit later on, a man from Minnesota who learned about his grandmother who died young. She was born in the United States, never left the country, died in the United States, and then he found out that she had lost her citizenship as a result of one thing she did. And so she died a citizen of no country at all. Our guest was troubled by this and went to do something to honor his grandmother and others in a similar situation. You're going to want to hear my visit with Daniel Swalm from Minnesota coming up in about 8 minutes. Then later in the show, we'll talk to a man who learned early on about the power of digitization. In fact, he fell in love with it and started a website that has triple the number of digitized newspaper pages than the Library of Congress. Who is this man? What's the site? How can you benefit from it? You're going to want to catch my visit later on the show with Tom Treniski from Fulton, New York. This segment of the show is brought to you by MyHeritage.com. Right now, let's go to Boston and talk to my good friend, the chief genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org, David Allen Lambert. Hello, sir.
Hello. Greetings from Beantown in post-St. Patrick's Day celebrated Boston.
Yes, I bet you that was quite the party there. I'm kind of going through this withdrawal right now, David, from Downton Abbey. My wife and I have watched this, of course, for 6 seasons. We didn't catch up with it, actually, until about the 3rd season and then followed it faithfully all the way through to the end. And the other day, I found online, trying to figure out exactly how all these family members of the Crawley family tied together, there's a Crawley family genealogy online.
And oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it goes back. Remember at the end, it had the third cousin once removed. We had, Matthew and all these different branches of the family. And, of course, the children, now the grandchildren and the new husbands and all this. So I posted it on our Facebook page with Extreme Genes. It has been reposted countless times, viewed thousands of times now. It has gone absolutely nuts because everybody loves Downton Abbey.
Well, and I love Downton Abbey now, too. But I must tell you that I've only been a fan since Christmas time, where I sat down. We watched season 1. We binged watched in about 2 months the entire series and watched the very last episode the night before it actually aired on TV. So I'm caught up with the clan completely.
What a great show it was. And I'm looking forward to what Julian Fellowes comes up with next, because he's got a deal with NBC for a show called The Gilded Age, which is going to talk about New York City in the 1880s. And it's going to be on network television.
Oh, that's going to be
coming
wonderful.
Out next year.
Well, there's gold found everywhere. If it's not on TV, it's out in the eastern part of Galilee. I don't know if you saw the story about the 2,000-year-old Roman coin. That's amazing. Lori Ryman, while out hiking, looked down and found this coin that dates from around 107 AD of the former Emperor Trajan, which was an image that was in honor of him by the current Emperor Augustus. I mean, I was a metal detector kid and, you know, still use it occasionally. I've never found anything 1,000 years old just lying on the surface.
No.
But a very lucky lady.
Incredible.
Yes. So something washed out of a wall or something.
And it's in great shape.
Amazing. In great shape. And apparently it's so very rare. And I understand that it is now in the possession of the Department of Antiquities in Israel. So it will be shared by all the people out there. And that's the great thing about archaeology, is that you just never know what the amateurs might find. As
exactly.
We've seen with the Anglo-Saxon Viking hordes that we've talked about. Well, going back a little further west from Galilee, northwest actually, we go to just a recap on St. Patrick's Day history. Do you realize that St. Patrick's Day as a holiday didn't start until 1631? And that was centuries after, in fact, 12 centuries after the death of St. Patrick himself. It started as a church feast. But did you realize that St. Patrick really wasn't from Ireland?
No, I did not know that. Where
yes,
was he from?
He was a Roman.
No.
And we should really be calling it St. Maiwen's Day or Maiwen's Day. His real name was not Patrick. It was Maiwen Sucat, they believe. And he changed it to Patricus, which is a Latin term for father figure. And of course, became a priest and is well known for converting the Druids to Christianity. And the American side of this holiday, well, it didn't come over with the Pilgrims. The first celebration in America that they can see occurred in your great old state of New York in 1762. And the idea of wearing green doesn't go back from the leprechauns. It's actually dates from about 1798 during the Irish Rebellion.
Wow.
So, gave me a little bit of a wake-up call on what I knew about my own Irish heritage.
Well, happy May Wednesday.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'll tell you, we're talking about things trending, and I am DL Genealogist on Twitter, and I've got a lot of followers, and I follow a lot of people back. But this tech tip that I came up with on the back of a post-it note, really, was to create a longevity chart. Well, it's trending and being retweeted all over the place. It's a simple idea. As I told you, I just took a regular genealogy chart, or a pedigree chart, as some people will call it, and instead of putting in the names, I put in the age at death of my parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, and great-great. And you look at it, and you realize how different of a focus we're looking at in genealogy. And if somebody died, like by they were shot or killed during a war or suicide, circle that number because that's not a basis. But I look at it and I say the average mean age that I could live to doesn't look like I'm going to push 90. So
yeah, right.
It's a fun little tech tip. It's free, something to do. And of course, on AmericanAncestors.org, as a guest user, you can get our free databases. And the ones we're highlighting this week include Brooksville, Maine, and Farmington, Maine, which are records from the 18th and 19th century of their birth, marriages, and deaths. That's all I have for this week from Beantown. I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
All right, David. Great stuff as always, and have a happy St. May Wednesday.
The same to you, sir.
And coming up next, I'll talk to a Minnesota man who discovered that his grandmother died without being a citizen of any country, despite having lived in the United States her entire life and never having left. The best of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And you know, most of us, when we get into research, we kind of sum it all up in a book, maybe something we share with the immediate family or some extended family or some close friends. But really, that's about it. But my next guest actually discovered something that he wanted to take to a larger audience, like the United States Congress, and you're going to want to hear why. He's Daniel Swam from Minnesota.
Thank you for having me on.
Just delighted to have you here, and let's just start with what your project was, and then we'll get to where this went, because it's really quite remarkable. You, like many of us, wanted to know a little more about your family.
Yes, I was researching family history a number of years ago. I came across a piece of information that I had no idea existed. My grandmother, Elsie Knutson Morin, was born near Lake Superior in Minnesota's Arrowhead Country in 1891, and she lived all of her life in Minnesota. She married my grandfather, who was a Swedish immigrant, a carpenter who came and settled in northeastern Minnesota.
And a lot of Scandinavians settled in Minnesota.
Lots, yes, is very, very Scandinavian, particularly on the North Shore. It's a mining and fishing and lumbering area, just like the old country. And they were married in 1914. Probably unbeknownst to her, and certainly unbeknownst to me as I was doing research, I discovered that on her wedding day in 1914, she was stripped of her American citizenship.
What?
Yes. She was stripped of her American citizenship. The Congress had passed in 1907 a law that was called the Expatriation Act. And it was a law that basically stated that if any American-born woman married somebody who was an immigrant who was not naturalized, and my grandfather was not naturalized at the time they were married, then that American woman, her citizenship was forfeit. And the law was retroactive, so when it was passed in 1907, it meant that people that had been born and were married in the 1800s retroactively lost their citizenship.
I did not know that. I've never heard that. Amazing.
Well, It's kind of one of those unknown pieces of American history that probably not Congress's finest hour.
Right.
The law was enforced by three presidential administrations, the Roosevelt administration, the Taft administration, and the Wilson administration. And the law was challenged in 1915 at the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld the validity of the law.
Wow.
So it was a very bizarre law. And as women's suffrage gained steam.
Right, up to 1920.
Yes. Parts of the law were repealed in 1922 with a piece of legislation called the Cable Act. And then in 1940, the law was completely repealed.
Now help me to understand something, though, here, Daniel. Sure. And that is, if this went retroactively back into the 1800s, what happened when the man would naturalize? Would the woman automatically become an American citizen again?
Right. Then she was renaturalized. She became a naturalized American citizen. Kind of weird because she was already born here. I mean, so... And the issue that I discovered, how I actually discovered it, was that there was a form that people had to fill out back in those days. It was called the Alien Registration and Property Form. And what they did is the government had this form and people had to fill it out and turn it in. And the rationale behind that was that if a Mrs. Rockefeller or a Mrs. Carnegie or you know, somebody from the Gilded Age married the Duke of Bulgaria or the Baron of who knows where in Europe, their money and property would not have been allowed to be transferred. Now, you have to remember that...
Wow.
In the 19-teens, that was during the time of World War I was going on, and then the United States entered in 1917, and that was when my grandma's document was dated. I had no clue, because this was never talked about by my parents and in my family, because Grandma Elsie died in 1926. She died in childbirth. Both she and the baby died.
Quite young.
Yes, she was probably about 35. And then my grandfather did not get his naturalization until 1928. As I was researching this and finding all this stuff out, I just kept digging and poking and researching, and what I found was that this had not just affected my grandmother, but it had literally affected thousands and thousands of people all over the United States.
And so your grandmother, because her husband didn't naturalize till after her passing, actually died as I wouldn't say a foreign citizen, just as a citizen of no country at all, right?
She was, exactly. She died expatriated and not a citizen of any country, even though she lived her entire life in the Arrowhead of Minnesota. Never left the country, to the best of my knowledge. They were not a wealthy. My grandfather was a carpenter. She was a housewife. They had three previous children, my mother and then my two uncles, and they have all since passed away. But yeah, it was just one of those historical oddities. And the more that I researched it and the more I found out about it, the more irritated I got.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. Now, this thing wasn't repealed before she passed either. So
no.
This applied to many people, and many people listening no doubt have ancestors in a similar situation.
Absolutely. So what I did a number of things. I wrote an editorial for the local paper here in the Twin Cities, for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, about my grandmother's story. It was titled, The Citizens That a Nation and Time Forgot, and it's still online, and people can still Google it and find it. I then started a Facebook page called Justice for Elsie, which I told the story. And then I also met with representatives of Senator Al Franken and told them the story. And much to my surprise, they were very interested. Nobody had heard of this. They were very interested in it. And so we began a process to either restore citizenship to my grandmother and these women, or to at least have that wrong acknowledged in some way. And as we went on, it became apparent that it was just going to be too much of a legislative nightmare to posthumously restore the citizenship, which kind of irritated me because the law that stripped people of citizenship was retroactive. So,
yes.
Oh, no, well, we don't do that anymore.
Oh, I see.
So then I hit on the idea that the Senate passes resolutions. And I said, how about if we write a resolution that the Senate can then vote on, that it will apologize, that will acknowledge the wrong that was done to Grandma Elsie and to all of the other grandmas out there, and see where that goes. The story was picked up by a reporter from the Los Angeles Times.
And look at it go.
And look at it go, exactly. The Washington Post had a story about it. I mean, and so I started hearing from people all over the country, and we were able to find co-sponsors for Senator Franken's resolution. And so the first person to sign on was Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Senator Franken's a Democrat, Senator Johnson is a Republican. And so right there, you know, we had some bipartisan consensus.
Yep. Holy cow, Grandma Elsie could bring the whole country together.
Grandma,
here.
Boy, I tell you, you know, Grandma Elsie was rocking. And the resolution was finally passed this past month unanimously.
Wonderful.
In the Senate. Unbelievable. And I have to say that this had nothing to do with me, because I'm not connected enough or smart enough or anything to do any of this. This was something where I was being guided by some kind of higher power, wherever that
Absolutely.
Higher power resides, because they were filling me with the right words to say to the right people at the right time, because I don't have the smarts to do that on my own.
Well, maybe Grandma Elsie doesn't have her citizenship back, but she certainly has been acknowledged in the right places, the United States Senate.
And we made it happen. And Memorial Day, at the Women's Suffrage Memorial Garden in St. Paul, on the grounds of the Minnesota State Capitol, I met with Senator Franken, and there were members of the public at large and the media there, and Senator Franken spoke and talked about his efforts in the Senate, and presented me with a copy of the official resolution with the seal of the Senate on it, framed the whole nine yards, which was a very nice honor to receive. And I presented Senator Franken with the only photograph of Grandma Elsie, signed from her entire family, which is now, you know, I'm her grandson, and then there's great-grandchildren, and then there's great-great-grandchildren.
Well, you've absolutely written a new chapter in your family history, and it's a big one.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Daniel Swam from Minnesota, thank you so much for your time and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
And coming up, we're going to talk to a man who started his own website of digitized newspapers and has three times the number of pages as the Library of Congress, as we continue with the best of Extreme Genes. It's the best of Extreme Genes. This is the first time I've actually got to talk to one of my genealogical heroes. He's a man who has put together a website of digitized newspapers that is bigger than that of the Library of Congress. And he's done it all by himself with no sponsorships, no ads on his site, no memberships. Tom Trinitsky, it is a pleasure and an honor to meet you. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you.
The site is called FultonHistory.com. If you go there, it's kind of, I would say it's artistic, Tom. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it is.
It has bubbles and fish and old-time radio shows on there, and it kind of hides the fact that the reality is there is more information on New York State than is probably on any other site you can think of. When did you start this thing, Tom, and why?
Well, actually, I started it probably in the late 1990s. I retired very early at 49, and I basically started with a box of old Fulton, New York postcards that was loaned to me by a fellow worker.
From Fulton County, New York? Is that what you're saying?
No, this was Fulton, New York.
Fulton, New York.
Which is in Oswego County.
Okay.
And those postcards depicted Fulton back in its heyday. It was a very, very busy town. You can get a job anywhere as you wanted. And the way the lawns were kept and the people kept their houses, it was phenomenal. And obviously, Fulton has gone through some hard times as of late. And these old postcards, I wanted to share them with people and didn't really know how about going about doing it. So I come up with the idea of putting up a real simple website. I guess my first name at that time was called Old Fulton, NY, New York, .ru.da. Yeah, I know it's a little strange.
Yeah,
but again,
yeah, we'll all remember that.
Yeah, I know it. And anyhow, I put the postcards up and mentioned it around Fulton, you know, and people got a really good kick out of that because, again, a lot of these people now never knew Fulton back in that day.
Sure.
Really showed a lot of interest. So then I branched into newspaper scanning, and I scanned the local newspapers, Swiggle Valley News, which was on a tabloid size scanner, and it took me just about a year to do the whole run. And I did one page at a time, and while I was scanning it, I was reading the next page. So it was very interesting. That newspaper was what we call very photo-rich, and it would take pictures of birthdays, graduations, retirements, you name it, full of photos. And at that time, I was just getting into word recognition, and I had tried a bunch of programs. And I said, well, let's see how that works with the newspaper. And I was amazed at the quality I was getting out of the scans and the word recognition.
Yes.
I put the website up and started doing the newspaper and got around town, and people were just floored by putting a key word out there, and also they see a
yes.
picture of themselves, graduation or retirement or what have you. And it kind of really took off at that point. As time go on, I wanted to add more newspapers, but the newspapers that I wanted to add were bigger than the tabloid scanner I had. And at that point, I realized if I was going to stay doing this, I had to go out and buy a microfilm scanner. And I wanted to see how it handled the quality of the microfilm that I get, which is usually very poor.
Right.
I work generally with just what we call service copies. It's usually, I call it also the bottom of the barrel microfilm.
Now, where do you get these things? The number of papers you have more than the Library of Congress. You have more than pretty much all the major companies have out there. Obviously, you got a big start on it. What are you at, 26 million pages now?
I have, right now, even though the site says 26,800,000, I'm way over that because I just don't do an update every time I get a new run of newspapers. So,
well, let me ask you this. Are there more papers from New York City to come?
Yes. I am looking at adding a couple of the big runs, and I just been see what the availability of it. That's one of the big things that I try to do is I got to contact these various libraries that have it and see if they'll let me borrow it. And, you know, as part of the deal is, if they let me borrow it, I give them a complete digital copy of it for their use, you know, if they want to use it for.
Sure.
And that's a good deal, I think, for me and them because
totally.
To go out and have that done.
I think that's how most people do it now, right?
Yep, that's right.
Well, tell me some stories, Tom, about people and their discoveries that have touched your heart and made you feel good about what you've done.
I get these all the time. These people will come onto my site and they'll do a search not thinking they're going to get nothing. Because, again, even though I'm heavily into New York State newspapers, New York State newspapers also included information from other newspapers across the United States because they used the wire to use it as fillers on their newspaper.
Yes.
And they'll come in and type in a keyword, and all of a sudden it pops up in a New York State newspaper about something that they never dreamed would be there. And, I always get these things. You know, I never knew anything about my family, about what they did. They never talked about this particular great-grandfather or something, and now I know why, because he found out that this guy might have been in jail or murdered somebody. You know, it's just things like that that pop up that you just never knew you would be able to find out anything about it.
Well, and I'll tell you that one of the things that you printed that nobody else has gave me the name of a third great-grandfather I'd been looking for 30 years. And
wow.
I was able to match his burial information from the newspaper with the grave in Brooklyn, New York. Found he was buried with a previously unknown daughter of a great-grandmother of mine, which basically proved that he was the right guy.
Yeah.
And then his presence proved who she was. So I wouldn't have found one without the other. That got me back into Connecticut, and ultimately that line took me back to the Mayflower. And that's
yeah,
because
wow.
of what you'd done.
Wow. Yeah, I get that type of information all the time from people. And, you know, that's probably what I get the most kick out of. Hearing those stories, I said, my God, this is great, you know. So, I mean, that, things like that which keep me going on this. As you know, I don't make any money on these projects, but I sure do like hearing these stories.
Well, now tell me why it is you haven't commercialized this. It is free to everybody. We need to tell them the address, right? It is FultonHistory.com.
Right.
And you mentioned New York State probably because you think of that first because you live there. But you have the greatest collection of New York City newspapers anywhere. And so many Americans come through New York City. They may find what they're looking for there. But why not commercialize it? Why is it you haven't pursued a dollar on this thing, not even ads on your site, Tom?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people enjoy the site as it is free because, quite frankly, they can't afford the pay sites.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to penalize somebody just because they haven't got a few dollars in their pocket from, you know, accessing this information. Again, I do accept donations, and I think that's the best way to do it. People then that can afford it do make a donation. People that cannot afford it, they don't. I mean, that's kind of like the way it is.
And that's basically just to cover your costs because you're not making anything from this.
No, I mean, it doesn't, I'll be honest with you, it doesn't even cover my costs. My running costs alone for the broadband is over $600 a month. I don't make anything near that per month.
It's just your passion.
Absolutely. Again, I retired early, and I was not the type of guy to ever just sit around and do nothing. Believe me, this takes up a lot of my time.
Oh, there's no question, and we can see that. Well, it's a great service, perhaps the greatest single service of any individual in America right now on behalf of those people who have New York ancestry and maybe, as you mentioned, from several other places. So thank you so much for what you do, Tom. Long life and good health that you can keep this thing going. And once again, it is FultonHistory.com. How many pages do you think you're up to? You say it's not 26.8 million anymore. It's way beyond that.
I would say 27 million, maybe 300,000 right now. Again, I'm going to have another update in the fall, and, you know, we'll see how far along I am.
We're almost triple the Library of Congress's efforts, all by yourself. Amazing.
Well, the Library of Congress has a lot of bureaucracy around it, so, I mean, things take time when they do things, and I can understand that.
Well, I'm sure they look at you with raised eyebrows. He's Tom Trinisky. He's the founder of FultonHistory.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom.
Okay, thank you very much.
And coming up next, we'll talk clouds with our preservation authority, Tom Perry, on the Best of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, and we'll be back next week with new guests and new stories for you to devour. And welcome to Cloud Talk on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show at ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority we have on every week. And Tom, we're just talking about this off air. It is just amazing how quickly things are changing with the cloud and how that is kind of confusing. You know what it really reminds me of? Going way back when fax machines first came out.
Yep.
Remember this?
Yep, absolutely.
Fax machines came out and businesses immediately went to these things because it was a huge boon in communication. And yet there were so many people who hadn't even heard of them yet, and they were already in all the businesses around the country. Wait a minute. What does the fax machine do? We could have this at home, remember?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Any place you had a phone plugged, you could have a fax machine.
Right, and so everything has changed. Now the cloud has kind of become, I think in some ways, very much the same thing as a 21st century version of the fax machine, where it's out there, everybody's using it, but there's still a huge number of people kind of left scratching their head going, well, wait a minute, what do I count on? How do I use it? What should it cost me? Why should I use it?
And exactly.
All these things.
Oh, you know, that is absolutely the best comparison I've ever heard of what the cloud is. Even before this, when there were copy machines, which actually turned into fax machines, you'd go into the precursors to Kinko's, and they didn't let you touch the machines. You would hand them your stuff. They would run it. And then they started letting you start doing it. If you can power on your computer, you can store stuff in the cloud. It's really that easy. It's not as hard as people think it is.
Right. And we're addressing folks who are just getting started in this and in storage and in preservation of their digital material.
And some people are intimidated. They think, oh, I don't want to learn this new software. I don't want to learn how to fix my pictures. Storing stuff on the cloud isn't like that. It's not something new you need to really learn. Anybody that's even a virgin at computers can figure out how to do this. You have an icon on your desktop, but you tell it that's where you want to store everything, is on Lightjar or iCloud or your Google Drive or Dropbox. And once it's set up, it does it for you in the background. You just keep dropping it, dropping it, and dropping it. And one of the neatest things about the cloud that I love is whether I'm on the road, if I'm home, if I'm at work, I can access any of my stuff. I don't have to, make a backup of this drive, keep it on this thumb drive, haul it with me. I can go any place. There's an internet connection, even on an airplane, and I can go to Dropbox and work on a Photoshop document or work on my genealogy or anything I want to. And the neat thing about it is, my sister Diane might be interested in these photos that I just found, so I send her an invite. She gets an email. She has access to just that folder that I gave her permission to. It's almost like one of those too-good-to-be-true things. It is absolutely incredible, and everybody needs to get some kind of cloud storage. We had a friend that just lost her house just the other day that burnt to the ground, and all her stuff was in it. They had nothing on the cloud, so basically, if their brothers or sisters or other relatives didn't have any copies of what they had just had in their house, they've lost everything.
Yes, that's right. And we just had a disaster at our home radio station of past storage. Now, fortunately, of course, everything for Extreme Genes is stored on a cloud. So while it took some time to restore everything that had been lost locally, it was there. And,
exactly.
We were able to get back in business pretty darn fast. But this is such an important thing to understand if you're just getting started in family history that, the cloud is a simple thing that takes care of itself. In fact, I've got one that every 15 minutes it goes through and looks for any changes I've made in my computer at all and makes those changes and duplicates them in this cloud storage area.
And like you say, instant is what's so important. In fact, right after the break, let's talk a little bit about how instant this thing can be. But you don't have to keep everything on every single computer. You can give certain parameters of what you want to keep on each individual computer.
We've been talking about, I guess you'd call this clouds 101.
Exactly.
Because there's, like we talked about earlier, it's a little bit like it was with fax machines. They came along very quickly, and a lot of people are left scratching their heads going, wait, do I have to have this? Does it have to cost? Is it hard to use? What do I do with it? And this is a lot of folks who are just now perhaps getting into family history preservation.
Oh, absolutely. Like we've done film transfers for people that we say, hey, do you want us to put it on the cloud? Then you have it instantly. You don't even have to come back in the store. We don't have to ship it to you. It's like, it's this big haunting thing. Oh, no, I can't do the cloud. I don't know a computer very well. I can spend 10 minutes with somebody and show them how to use the cloud. Because like I say in the earlier segment, once it's set up, it rocks and rolls. And the neat thing about having all your stuff in the cloud, if you're at home and you're working on something, I was going to finish this thing for this report for the meeting in the morning. I'm going to work on that now instead of going in early. You go into the cloud, you pull it down, and there it is. Like I just bought one of those new mini iPads I use as a GPS in my Suburban because it doesn't have a GPS and it's cheaper to do that. As soon as I bought it, I plugged it in, typed in my thing, boom, all my photos, all my apps, everything are right there. I don't have to re-download them. I don't have to go search for them. I don't even have to pay for them again because of the way they're set up. So this iPad I sent up last night already has everything on it that I need. And that's the way it is with the cloud. Like sometimes I get the warning on my computer says, you're running out of memory. So I go to my Dropbox and I say, I don't really need these things on this computer because I don't access them very well. So I go in and say, hey, don't need it on this computer anymore. So it erases them from the computer. They're still in the cloud. So now I have all this memory. But yet if one day I go, I really do need that. Go back in, click on it. And 5-10 minutes, it's all back there again.
Right. Download it again. And the question also always comes up about security with cloud. Everybody kind of concerned about that. And certainly there's risk of security with anything you do. I would suggest that there's the possibility that security on your home computer is probably riskier than security on a cloud like Google Drive or Dropbox.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody could break into your home and steal your computer. They've got everything that's on your computer. And even if you have it encrypted with passwords, most people, unfortunately, don't change their password very often, or they have something really easy like their birth date or the name of their dog or their firstborn kid.
Or 1234.
Oh, I have actually had customers call and say, hey, I need you to download this stuff off my phone. I want it on a video DVD. In fact, we tell them, change your password, send that to us, and then change it back so we don't have it. They go, oh, no, it's easy. It's just 1234. And I'm going, okay, you just gave me your password. What other devices do you have that have the same password? So security is important. I have never heard of a breach on the cloud. I'm sure someday it will happen. But these guys, they've learned from all the mistakes with Target and Home Depot that their stuff is so redundant now. Nothing's perfect, but I mean, it's getting close to being there. But it's just so nice that anytime you need anything, it's right there on Dropbox. And like I mentioned in the first segment, if you have relatives that you're working on things with that you want to collaborate, you open up a Dropbox folder that everybody has access to. So they can drop photos in, you can drop photos in, they can look at it instantly. They're not sending things, they're not getting discs and mailing them. It saves you so much time. It's just absolutely a must-have. Everybody needs to have a cloud. And as you mentioned, it's not expensive. A lot of clouds are even free if you keep your memory under so much. We have tons because we do lots of video for people, but yet we spend less than $100 a year. That's less than $10 a month for terabytes worth of storage. So it's awesome. If you can get two clouds, make sure the clouds aren't related. Whether you want Google Drive, iCloud, Dropbox, Lightjar, iCloud, get them.
All right. Good stuff, Tom. Thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here.
Hey, that wraps up our show for this week. I am Fisher, and we'll all be back next week with a brand new edition of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Thanks once again to Daniel Swalm from Minnesota for sharing his story about his grandmother, who through no fault of her own lost her citizenship and what he did to honor her. And to Tom Treniski from FultonPostcards.com for telling us his incredible story. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.